The reason I love my job so much, particularly the part of the job that makes me do an episode of Cut the Clutter every day, is that it makes me learn so many new things. It keeps me curious, honest, and also humble, because every other day I realize how little I know about something which is quite important and which at some point of time would become so important in our lives that we might have to record an episode of Cut the Clutter about this. Now, who had ever imagined that I will be doing a Cut the Clutter episode about Indonesia? And this is not even in the context of security. I know that India and Indonesia have now a tight and very important security partnership. See the map of India, the island properties of India, that is Andaman, Nicobar, and Greater Nicobar Island, and see Indonesia and the Indonesian archipelago, the western end of the Indonesian archipelago, that is Banda Aceh. You can see that from the last point on the Indian Nicobar Island, Greater Nicobar, something called Indra Point, from there to Indonesian coast in Aceh is just 142.5 kilometers. That's all. That's how close we are as neighbors. And between us lies this maritime boundary. And then this is what leads into Malacca Strait. And Malacca Strait is that infamous, depending on which side you're looking at it from. If you're looking at it from the Chinese side, probably you will think it's infamous. This is one of the key choke points in the Indo-Pacific, right? A lot of the important shipping for the rest of the world, Western world, China, between the rest of the world and China, Japan, etc., passes through this strait. And that's why it's strategic. It's quite narrow. Somebody shuts it down, or somebody has a couple of silent submarines with a bunch of torpedoes and missiles sitting at the bottom of it. Shipping for a hostile power is nearly impossible. So India and Indonesia have a partnership. The other important thing is that Indonesia is held to be the model Islamic country. It is the third largest democracy in the world. In fact, on all the major democracy indices, it ranks higher than India. It is the only genuine democracy among Islamic countries. Look, I mean, with apologies to Pakistan, even Bangladesh, this is rated higher than those, right? So this is a very genuine democracy, despite being a large Islamic majority. 88%, precisely about 87.8% of the population of Indonesia is Muslim, of which about 99% is Sunni. The rest is Shia and maybe a few Ahmadiyyas, etc., etc. Then there is a very heavy Hindu cultural overhang there, because a lot of the culture has come from Indians who settled there, Indian rulers, particularly in the south of India, who had maritime resources, who built maritime powers. So you find Hindu and Indian influence everywhere, but Hindu population, by the way, is just 1.7%. And yet you find more and more prominent Indonesians whose names sound Hindu. For example, one of the former presidents was Megawati Sukarnoputri, whose father was late Sukarno, who was the kind of founder of Indonesia. Now, one more reason Indonesia is held in such high esteem, particularly in India, you will find leaders of the RSS, leaders of the BJP, you will find intellectuals close to the RSS and BJP, close to the Hindu right, hold out Indonesia as the shining light of liberal Islam. Look, this is an Islamic country, huge Islamic majority, which is a democracy, functioning classical democracy now since 1998. Until then, it was a dictatorship for a long time. I'll tell you something about that in a bit. But also an Islamic nation, a wide Islamic majority, which is very fair to its minorities. That's about 11% Christians and 1.7%, say 2% Hindus, and a smattering of Buddhists. So everybody practices their religion. They have Ramayana there, Ram Leela there, their own version of Ram Leela. Everybody goes to everybody's festivals. It's the perfect secular world. For an Islamic country, what else can you ask? Now, I've given you this long preamble. You might wonder where am I reaching. Because if you've seen the Indian press, certainly if you've seen Indian TV, you haven't seen any reason why we should be talking about Indonesia today. That's because a lot of the world press now told us, in fact, late last night when I was scrolling global newspapers and publications while watching the football match, and what a bummer of a match it was, how easily the South Koreans lost, sad it was. But it was in that period that I discovered a story in the New York Times. And then that led me to many other stories, including in the Indonesian press. So Indonesian Parliament yesterday passed their new legal codes, particularly on the new criminal law. Now, they inherited a criminal law from the Dutch. Just as we inherited our Indian Penal Code from the British, it was made in 1860, and we have kept on making amendments to it. Indonesia used to be a Dutch colony, so they inherited their criminal law from the Dutch in 1918. They've been wanting to change it. Yesterday, the parliament voted to change it. Now, there are many changes. There are 628 new articles, so we are not telling about all of those, don't worry. But the fact is that some key changes have taken place, which have raised questions about Indonesia's status as a liberal, democratic, albeit an Islamic country, or an Islamic country, or maybe let me try and make it as free of spin as possible. A genuinely Islamic country, a large Muslim majority, which is also democratic with a classical functioning free democracy, freedom of speech, and also secular in the conduct of the state. These changes, this new legal code that they have passed, that the National Assembly of Parliament there has passed, challenges a lot of these set notions. So what are the key things that have happened? Then I will also tell you some key laws. Not definitively, I told you there are 628 of them, but the important ones. So first of all, this new law bans, in fact, it criminalizes all sex outside marriage. Now that is the subject of headlines globally, all sex outside marriage. That means not just sex outside marriage for married people, for unmarried people, maybe for widowed, divorced, any kind of people, single people, it just bans extramarital sex, which means to have sex, you have to be married, right? And if you are not, and if you are reported, and I will give you some idea of how you could be reported, you can go to jail for a whole year. That is, if you think that is the bummer, then also this new law bans live-in relationships. Right? Again, I will tell you how it is that you could be reported for having a live-in relationship and how you could be caught. Adultery has been banned always in Indonesia. It's still a conservative country because 88% Muslim, it's tough with that population to become a new Sweden, right? And that is not the expectation either. Countries have the right to be socially conservative if that's their tradition. So adultery was always banned in Indonesia, but not extramarital sex. Now that gets banned also. Then it goes on to say, you cannot say anything that's counter to state ideology. You cannot say anything that's critical of the president, the vice president. Now, first of all, the first reaction has come from the Singapore tourism industry. Singapore has a lot of islands. I told you it's an archipelago. It's not only is it an archipelago, it's the largest archipelago country in the world. It has 17,000 islands. Look at the map. And if I show you, if I pick up the map, in fact, you haven't seen this globe for a long time. I also haven't picked it up for a long time. But now looking at Indonesia, I have to see, I have to try and understand, and you will see this map enlarged on my screen. You will see where Indonesia is positioned, where these islands of the archipelago are positioned. This is a country critically positioned between Indian Ocean and the Pacific. So when it comes to Indo-Pacific, this is a true Indo-Pacific power. It's also a large country of nearly 28 crore people. I told you the third largest democracy in the entire world. Now, in that country also, the islands include Bali and other places, Jakarta itself, but also Bali, and enormous amounts of tourists come there. Now, what happens to these tourists when they check into these hotels? Do you check their marriage certificates, right? Do you check their sexuality? So it is the tourism industry which has first of all spoken out, because tourism industry has now said, look, our business will become unsustainable. Everybody will be scared of coming here. So Maulana Yusran, I note in the international media, he says, look, this will be totally counterproductive to tourism, particularly for the hotel industry, because hotels are critical to tourism. Now, if the hotels have to keep a watch over whether couples who check in together are married or not, or people having sex in a hotel are married or not, it's going to be a big, big, big problem. Law and Human Rights Minister of Indonesia, on the other hand, says, look, I know that there will be complaints about this, but this is the law that's been passed. And there's a quote from her, and I quote, it's not easy for a multicultural, multi-ethnic countries to make a criminal code that can accommodate all interests. Now, if you read this, it isn't just all interests. This country, the big country, important country, has gone in some other direction all together. Again, all these sexual restrictions now and criminalization of sexual behavior, it makes like life difficult for all LGBT people. Why has the government done it? This is the government under Joko Widodo. Joko Widodo, who also has a nickname in those parts. Everybody has a nickname. His nickname is Jokowi. He's still preening after finishing his presidency of G20. Before Narendra Modi, the presidency of G20, it happens by rotation. It was with Joko Widodo, and he enjoyed the limelight. All the global leaders came to his country. Just as they have left, he's done it. Is he doing it for a re-election? Possibly not, because 2024 is when Indonesia will have its next re-election, the same year as India. But Widodo will not be the candidate. That is according to the system in Indonesia. He cannot seek a re-election. But everybody has party interests, and everybody plays towards that one gallery, which is the voter gallery. Now the most detailed analysis of these changes has come from Human Rights Watch. And I'm sharing with you a report from Human Rights Watch, which has said that, look, this is, and I quote, disastrous for all, not just for women, minorities and LGBT communities. So what these law do is, it makes it very difficult for anybody to seek contraception. It criminalizes abortion. Also, it effectively puts a censorship on dissemination of any information about contraception. I will tell you the specific laws in a minute. This also strengthens a blasphemy law that Indonesia passed in 1965. Now, 1965 was a tough time for Indonesia. 1965 was around time that Sukarno's government was on its last legs. It was losing support and popularity, and that's when General Suharto led a coup. It was a very bloody coup that had a very violent outcome that led to the death of nearly half a million people, and then to a change of regime. Sukarno lost power, General Suharto came in. 1965 is when Indonesia passed their Blasphemy Act. That Blasphemy Act has now been strengthened. Now, if I may digress for just half a minute, 1965 is also when India and Pakistan fought a war. When India and Pakistan fought a war, at that point of time, that Indonesian regime was very pro-Pakistan, extremely pro-Pakistan. And at that time, Indonesian regime then, and remember, this was the transition. Sukarno was a friend of India. Suharto had just come in, and he had many generals who were talking out of turn. And they had said that, look, what is Andaman Nicobar? This is closer to us than to Indian mainland. These island properties are ours. So while this war is going on, we are going ahead and taking over these islands. Of course, no such threat was carried out, because the global community at that point, Cold War was on, they would have come and hit them on the heads. So that didn't happen. But the fact is, at that time, there was that claim made, and the Pakistanis thought that, yes, now one fellow Muslim country is coming to our support. So that situation does not exist. That changed radically post 1971, and also further after the Cold War. So I am not going there. I just mentioned that as an aside, and also to make to you the point that Indonesia is a very important country for India in many ways. It's our biggest neighbor at the edge of the Indian Ocean as we move into the Pacific. So very important, and so very important, and a maritime neighbor. Now coming back to what exactly has happened. Now Indonesia decided that they had to change this law. So this has been debated for some time. 2019-20, Widodo himself has said, look, time may not have come to make these radical changes, but these changes were planned. Now the changes have gone through. And you know what? You know how this law has been passed? This law has been passed unanimously. I keep on telling you all the time that in all our divided democracies, I say this in India's context, but what applies in India also applies to other democracies. It's very difficult to pass good laws, but when you have a bad law, everybody votes for it. So everybody has voted in Indonesia unanimously for this law. Now this law in Indonesia, there is a complication. Indonesia has different sets of laws. So one is what is living laws, kind of modern laws. That in Indonesia, in local language, is called hukum adat, right? So hukum adat, you can see that there is some echo of the kind of language that might be used in official understanding, say from the 19th, 18th century of the laws in India. So there is hukum adat, that is like modern laws. And then there are Sharia laws. Now Sharia laws in Indonesia are also implemented or interpreted differently in many islands, in many areas, and that causes a lot of confusion. This code is meant to codify all that and remove those confusions, but see the result. So Article 417 of this law, that says extramarital sex, 1 year sentence, right? Currently also there is a law like that, but that law is more an adultery law, which means if within a marriage, one of the two partners has sex outside of marriage, he or she can be punished. So the complainant can only be either a child from that marriage, one of the children from that marriage, or one of the spouses. So Mia, Biwi or Bacche Razi, to kya karega Kazi? Kazi ka koi matlab nahi hai. In the new law, anybody can complain. Effectively, anybody can complain. And that then becomes the problematic thing. Now, what does it mean to LGBT community? Now, same gender sex is in any case criminalized in Indonesia, right? So if that is criminalized, then in any case, all LGBT behavior is criminalized in Indonesia. And what is the punishment for extramarital sex? It's 1 year in jail. Then Article 419. I know I'm used to the Indian system. So when it comes to criminal law, I keep lapsing into saying section. So this is not section in Indonesia, they say article, like we say for the constitution. So Article 419, living together. If two people are living together without being married, there is a 6 month jail sentence. And who can complain against you? It's not one of the spouses or anybody. It can be the village headman, or in a city, I presume it can be anybody in the Mohalla Council, or anybody who could be the equivalent of the Resident Welfare Association or RWA in Delhi, or maybe in a city like Mumbai, anybody who's running the society that manages that building. So do you really want to imagine a situation where any RWA uncle or auntie can go and complain against you? Those two people are living together, na? Pakad ke lao, 6 mahina jail. What will mostly happen is some policemen will get very rich in the process, but that is section, that is Article 419. Article 421, obscene acts performed in public, that effectively finishes all LGBT behavior, right? But also otherwise hugging even people of the other gender, hugging, kissing, any such behavior can be seen as obscene acts, and that gets you jail and fines. So if you add up Articles 417, 419, 421, it means it completely violates the right to privacy of all consenting adults. That's what the Human Rights Watch report says. I'm reading the details of these articles also from the Human Rights Watch report. Article 414 says that anybody shows, explains, offers, or prescribes or suggests contraception to anybody below 18 years of age will get a sentence of jail and fine. So you cannot educate anybody below the age of 18 even about contraception. But what happens? What happens if it comes to older people? All right, 18 से नीचे आपने बचा लिए, 18 के ऊपर क्या होगा? Even there, only doctors, health professionals and quote-unquote competent volunteers can explain contraception to adults purely only from the perspective of family planning and sexually transmitted disease. And if you violate that, then the wrath of Article 416 falls upon you. Then you have Articles 415, 470, 471. These tell you that only doctors can perform abortions, right? And if anybody else performs abortions, then it's a 5-year jail sentence. Even if a woman aborts her own pregnancy, it's a 4-year jail sentence, right? Somebody else, she seeks somebody's help to abort her pregnancy, it's a 5-year jail sentence. What this means is, Human Rights Watch says, what this means is that even selling of morning after pills or pills that women can take after a sexual encounter to prevent a pregnancy also now gets criminalized. So if you see all of these look like maybe the most draconian laws in the world interfering with human sexual behavior, mostly directed at women, but human sexual behavior. Now, Articles 304 and 309, if you read those carefully, they tell you that any deviation from established religions is not allowed and it's criminalized. And which are the six established religions there? Islam, Protestantism, Catholicism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and Confucianism. Now, who has such clearly defined doctrines, scriptures, etc. in any religion that then lay down this law for you? At least for Hinduism. Now, there's only 1.7% Hindus. But in the practice of Hinduism, what is deviating from your religious principles or religious practices? So once again, this is a law that will be misused more than used, but this will be a terrible thing. For Indonesia. Now, blasphemy in Indonesia is not taken as seriously as Pakistan. But since the law was passed, 150 convictions have taken place. One of those was a prominent man. He was the governor of the city of Jakarta. Jakarta is the second largest city in the world based on population. So Basuki Purnama, once governor of Jakarta, he was convicted for blasphemy. Then you have other laws which don't get into personal sexuality and all, but get into personal politics, and those are interesting. Article 118, there is a 4-year jail sentence for spreading Marxism-Leninism, right? Article 118, there is a 4-year jail sentence for spreading, not COVID virus, for spreading Marxism-Leninism. Article 119, there's a 10-year jail sentence if you spread Marxism-Leninism with the intent of changing government. And then Article 219, which is punishment for insult to president and vice president. This is a whole bunch of new laws that Indonesia has passed. Now, the only saving grace is, they say, look, people are doing stuff together, people have live-in relationships, people have other arrangements to make, it takes time for people to learn to adjust with changed laws. So we will start implementing these laws. They've passed now, but we will start implementing these, not just now, but after 3 years. But you know what? Those 3 years will pass sooner than we imagine. Now, Indonesia, besides our current strategic cooperation, we also have an older connection with Indonesia. Older, but not ancient. So late 1940s, when the Second World War ended, Dutch were the colonizers of Indonesia. They were more or less withdrawing. So Sukarno, who was then a freedom fighter, he had been leading a campaign for freedom of Indonesia. He declared freedom and the Dutch came to fight him, because Dutch wanted to recolonize Indonesia. So in that situation, there was a time when the leadership of Indonesia was threatened. Sukarno was very friendly with Nehru already. So it seemed like that his prime minister Sultan Sjarir and Muhammad Atta, who was his partner, it looked like they might be arrested or harmed by the Dutch. So Nehru decided to help Sukarno evacuate them. So who did Nehru ask? He asked his friend Biju Patnaik, that is Naveen Patnaik's father. Biju Patnaik was an adventurer, and a pilot. So Biju Patnaik in his Dakota, he flew to Singapore. There, from there, he flew his Dakota to Java, picked up Sukarno's prime minister and his partner, Mohammad Atta, his political partner, and flew them back to the safety of Singapore and then to India. And that was seen to be among the most adventurous things that Biju Patnaik did in his very adventurous life. In fact, the Dutch had threatened to shoot down his aircraft. He still flew. Later, the Dutch did shoot down one of his company's Dakotas, which was carrying stuff for Sukarno's people. In fact, subsequently, the Dutch did indeed shoot down one of his Dakotas, which was carrying help for Sukarno and his forces. Later, of course, the Dutch compensated India for the loss of that aircraft. So I thought, since we had talked about Indonesia and we don't do that all the time, I shall tell you this story also. You want to read more about it, I will share a link with you. That's a story by Manisha Mandal on the print, exactly on this incident of Biju Patnaik rescuing Sukarno's people.